part 8 of 13 from set number 2005, introducing C.G. Jung's Red Book, a BC Recordings copyrighted presentation by Stefan Heller entitled Jung's Red Book, Conclusion of the Final Chapter of Book 2.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, after a long hiatus occasioned by Christmas and Epiphany and various matters of that sort, we resume our studies of the Red Book of C.G. Jung, and in order to perhaps put some of this material in the proper sequence, I need to mention some circumstances that have to do with the writing and the compilation of the book that probably we mentioned in bare outline form, but that we may need to be reminded of, and that is this, that of course Jung did not write the Red Book immediately in the beautiful calligraphed and illustrated form that we see in the book, but that the text of the Red Book was first written by Jung into much smaller, much more unpretentious notebooks, which are covered in black, and characteristically they are called the Black Books. And you will see some of them exhibited at the Red Book exhibit that is coming to our great delight to Los Angeles, and that I've just been informed will start at the Armand Hammer Museum on the 11th of April. And will be there, I think, through the early part of June. I'm not quite sure how long. There are some of the black books exhibited there too. Then from the black books, there were yet other stages where the material there was copied, then was typed, then Jung looked it over, added to it, and then he transferred them, often with some amendations, with his beautiful, unusual calligraphy, which he never used for any other purpose, into the Red Book. Now, I am not good at figures, by which I mean numbers, and so I will not go into which year which portion was written, but the Red Book as such, the calligraphed version of the Red Book as it stands, was written, as I recall, not much more than about a year's time. And then at World War I came, Jung entered the Swiss Army as a medical corps officer. I think he had the rank of either captain or major, and that took him to various places. He was guarding interred prisoners in and so forth. That sort of the whole matter was interrupted. And then he continued subsequently. And there is also a very large portion, which we will begin next time, which never came to be entered in calligraphed or other form into the Red Book, but which quite obviously belongs to it. It was in, again, in the black notebooks, and the dates, the first date of that particular portion, picks up right where the previous one ends. So it was obviously intended as a continuation, but that was included in the Red Book only now at its publication and was never transcribed in the calligraphy by Jung. And that is the portion, quite a large one, which is entitled Scrutinies. That is what we will begin on next time. And actually, Scrutinies is in many ways the sort of quintessential summary of Jung's conclusions from the Red Book. Scrutinies also contains that famous scripture of Jung's called the Seven Sermons to the Dead, which was extracted by him from Scrutinies and published as a small, privately printed, but very beautifully produced little printed book and was then distributed to a fairly close circle of friends. I have a copy of that, which I treasure very greatly, and probably accompanied by several security guards and guard dogs. We will bring it down here when we start on that portion. I'll show it to you. It was sent to me in appreciation by the late Mr. Franz Jung, who was Carl Jung's only son and the head of the family until his demise a few years ago. Now, the reason I mention this, because tonight we are concluding what in the original calligraphed form would really be the Red Book. We are dealing with the last portion of Book 2 of Liber Secundus, where that portion ends. But then obviously, owing to the fact that there was this other large scripture available, which quite obviously pertains to this material in the publication, Dr. Shamdasani decided to include it, and that is the part that we will start on next time. So I think with that we can go on with our material now, and we'll do a little bit of recapitulation as to where we left off. And so we have conducted our studies of the Red Book last time with chapter 21 of Book 2 of Liber Secundus, which was entitled The Magician. And the magician is Philemon, whom we encountered briefly before. As we might say, this is the role which Philemon is playing at this point in the book. He reveals himself as a magician. In fact, as so often, there are difficulties because of the language. The German word used for Philemon in that chapter is Zauberer. Now, Zauberer is not exactly the same as a magician, because there is such a word as a Magier, you know. But it's sort of the automaturg, what in popular lore maybe in the Appalachian Mountains would be called a conjure man, a conjuring man. So it's an ambivalent, strange title. And so Philemon in this chapter, which we dealt with last time, reveals himself increasingly as much more than a mere conjurer, much more than a mere magician. And that this magical personality is one of his disguises. It's one of his masks. Jung has discoursed with Philemon in that chapter, arguing with him occasionally, but all along we can see that Philemon is steadily growing in Jung's eyes. Philemon appears more and more as an awesome presence of immense importance. It even becomes apparent that Jesus has visited Philemon at some point. It's just a little reference. Jung addresses Philemon in parting in the following manner, and I am probably repeating now what we mentioned before. O master of the garden, I see your dark tree from afar in the shimmering sun. And then recognizing that Philemon's persona as a magician is a sort of disguise, he says, O master of the garden, your magical grove shown to me from afar, I venerate your deceptive mantle, you father of all will-o'-the-wisps. The chapter then concludes with a large painting of Philemon, which we saw several times, and you probably have seen it long before the Red Book was published, because that is one of the images that has been published before. This large painting of Philemon, who stands with his feet on top of a domed structure, a sort of a temple, his head surrounded by a golden halo, with two large trees in the background, as well as a more distant grove of trees. In front of the large tree, to the left of Philemon, is a large snake, all twisted up. And Philemon's picture bears a small Greek inscription, which I have never even discerned before in the various pictures until sometime a couple of years ago or so, maybe not even so long ago, we projected it here on the screen, and then I could see the Greek inscription, which translates, "Father of the prophets, beloved Philemon." On the margin of the page, there is a quotation from the Bhagavad Gita in English. I think that's, as far as I'm aware, that's the only portion of the entire Red Book that is in English, the rest of it all being in German, with some Latin and some Greek thrown in for spice, as it were. So, a quotation from the Bhagavad Gita wherein Krishna declares that whenever there is a decline of the good law and an increase of iniquity, he is reborn in every age in order to remedy those conditions. Very famous statement from the Bhagavad Gita. Not to be forgotten, Philemon bears the wings of the kingfisher. This is all the painting which is at the very end of chapter 21 of book 2, the chapter entitled The Magician, where actually the next chapter begins. One may conjecture that in this image Jung carries with him, that this is the image that Jung carries with him of Philemon, and perhaps also it is the image he wishes that others should have of Philemon. In fact, Jung had taken that very painting and produced another one as a mural, which is in one of the rooms which was used as a bedroom in the Bollingen Tower. Huge, big. Exactly the same thing as is in the book here. So, if indeed that was Jung's intention, that people should think of Philemon in that image that he here created, he certainly succeeded, if only at this late date, because this is the image that is the emblem of the Philemon Foundation and is appearing on thousands of pamphlets and flyers around the world, you know, advertising both the Red Book and the various other publications of the Philemon Foundation. Jung has painted a slightly altered, much larger version of it, which is in the Bollingen Tower. Now, after we look at that picture, Jung says he proceeds on his way, leaving Philemon's garden behind. Jung continues on his way. He carries, as he describes it, he carries a fine steel sword. He wears chainmail under his coat. He is accompanied by several serpents, curious pets to have around, but as he indicates, he has learned how to deal with them, and it seems that occasionally he kills them, because he says, "In my cave, I have many of their beautiful skins hanging." Now, I don't think those are skins that were shed. They were probably after decapitated them a bit, which is sometimes a nice thing to do with snakes. So he has learned how to charm the snakes with a flute. Magical melody has been imparted to him by Philemon, whereby he can charm the snakes anywhere, apparently. He is then attracted to a large iridescent serpent, and he plays a particular tone to this serpent, which he had learned earlier from Philemon. He seems to be playing a trick here, mollifying the serpent, even to the point of letting the serpent believe that she is his soul. Well, this turns out to be a little different than a different situation from the one that he initially envisions, because as we see for quite a while now, throughout the whole portion that we are dealing with today, he has various discourses with the serpent, and the serpent then actually reveals itself as his soul, or at least a particular portion. We will come to that later. So it's now, it is not sort of a spectral personality as in the beginning of the book, that appears as his soul, but it really appears as this particular large, beautiful serpent. There seems to be a particular insight that the serpent at this point is trying to awaken in Jung. the vision that comes to Jung is that of the interaction of the opposites, which we have seen him struggling with before, and which probably, along with the recognition of the indwelling Godhead, of the, which later on came to be described or denominated in his psychological writings as the self with a capital S, this issue of the relationship and the ultimate conjunction of the opposites are probably the two main themes in the entire Red Book. And that, I think, is quite important. You need to remember that Jung did not come to his study of alchemy yet at this particular time. That did not come until the 1920s, and this is the early, this is 1913, 1914, and as we will see at the end of today's chapter, he begins to come to a recognition that he might be able to communicate to the world what he has learned in the revelations of the Red Book in the form of alchemy. But that does not come until later. It was not until his association with Richard Wilhelm, the great sinologist, that he then began to work with alchemy and to express what is stated really in sort of prophetic, revelatory form in the Red Book, to translate that into alchemy. But interestingly enough, you know, the principle of the conjunction of the opposites, a major theme, of course, of alchemy, is already very powerfully present in the Red Book. And he is definitely talking about that with the soul serpent. He describes it to the serpent as follows: how holy, how sinful, how everything hot and cold flows into one another, how the opposites are always there and interact with each other in life. Madness and reason want to be married. The lamb and the wolf graze peacefully side by side. It is all yes and no. The opposites embrace each other, see eye to eye, and intermingle. They recognize their oneness in agonizing pleasure. My heart is filled with this battle, with this wild battle, in fact. The waves of dark and bright rivers rush together, one crashing over the other. I have never experienced this before. So it is at this point that this extremely important and mysterious issue of the relationship, the interaction, the ultimate conjunction of the opposites is brought to his attention powerfully in the Red Book. So what he has here is a vision, of course, of the conjunction of the opposites, a mystery which we find numerous smaller intimations in earlier portions of the Red Book. So all we can say about this at this point is that in order to have what might be called a unitive gnosis or ultimate wholeness, one has to experience or perhaps even undergo the union of the opposites. It is not my purpose to bring in a great deal of amplifying material from other sources here, but we certainly find a good many statements of an evidential nature in this regard in various Gnostic scriptures. Professor Quispel, of course, Jung's great Gnostic advisor, has even stated that when, for instance, in such a now rather popular scripture as the Gospel of Thomas, the illumined Gnostic is referred to as the solitary, that this should really be translated as the unified person, vir unus, the person who has become one, and that therefore an internal unification of the individual has been envisioned as the result of a Gnostic process in related schools of thought before, particularly that of the Gnostics. It is here in the conversation with the serpent that this realization comes to Jung with the greatest power. That is why he says, and I quote, "I have never experienced this before." We have a clue here also regarding the path Jung eventually chose to make the revelations of the Red Book known to a wider public, namely that of alchemy. Now, a further dialogue takes place between Jung and the serpent. The serpent indicates that the opposites have always been here, and that she, the serpent, has derived her power from these opposites. But that if these opposites were ever reconciled or united, then she would seemingly lose her power. Her power over Jung seems to consist of presenting him with various psychological opposites, such as pathos and banality and others. Now, I may as well introduce here the notion which appears with much greater clarity later, that the serpent is, well, how should we put it, sort of the terrestrial and chthonic, that is, submundane part of Jung's soul. There is an other, which is a bird, it's the white bird, which is the celestial part of his soul. And there is a relationship, no doubt, between this serpent and sort of serpent symbolism in other disciplines, as perhaps the Kundalini serpent of the Hindus and others. Without these opposites, says the serpent, she is always called she is helpless. Jung finally persuades the serpent to go into, and as he calls it, the deeper grounds to which she has entry, and ask someone there to give us counsel. Then in response comes this particular vision. Now a vision comes to him after the serpent went down to call for visions. Slowly the throne of God ascends into empty space, followed by the Holy Trinity, all of heaven, and finally Satan himself. He resists and clings to his beyond, whereby is really meant sort of his own non-physical region. He will not let it go. The upper world is too chilly for him. So we have here really the sort of the quaternary with which Jung dealt quite a bit later in life. The divine trinity of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and the fourth one who is the adversary, who is the devil. Once again, it's not an entirely novel notion. Ideas of this sort have occurred among mystics throughout history. Now, here we go. The serpent says, have you got tight hold of him, namely the devil? I, as Jung, welcome, hot thing of darkness. My soul probably pulled you up roughly, ? This is how one should talk to the devil, see? You hot thing of darkness. Why this noise? I protest against this violent extraction. Why don't you leave me where I was? I, calm down, I didn't expect you. You come last of all. You seem to be the hardest part. Satan, what do you want from me? I don't need you, impertinent fellow. I, it's a good thing we have you. You're the liveliest thing in the whole dogma. Well, there is something to be said for that, you know. But of course you also need to keep in mind, especially of the slightest familiarity with Goethe's Faust, that this is the kind of way in which Faust treats Mephistopheles. And Mephistopheles is not so much evil as he is a monumental cosmic trickster. And so he certainly enlivens things. Satan, what concern is your prattle to me? Make it quick, I'm freezing. You know, he's out of his own place. He had really good heating, central heating, where he came from. Now he's up here in the cold weather. Jung says to him, listen, something has just happened to us. We have united the opposites. among other things, we have bonded you with God. Satan says, for God's sake, why this hopeless fuss? Why such nonsense? And Jung says to him, please, that wasn't so stupid. This unification is an important principle. We have put a stop to never-ending quarreling to finally free our hands for real life. But and then the argument goes on, but this is his initial interaction with Satan, who just came up. This dialogue with Satan continues for a while. Satan tries to convince Jung that the life within the field of the opposites is the real life. In other words, don't try to reconcile, don't try to unite, but just allow yourself to be buffeted about by the opposites. That is the real life. That's where you are supposed to live. Jung decides that Satan is concerned with personal life, and that he has no concept of, as Jung calls it, the absolute and its forbearing patience, namely something beyond the ordinary personal life of people. Yet it seems that Jung comes to accept the devil's suggestion that the clash of the opposites is necessary for earthly or personal life. Jung has nothing good to say of Satan, the devil. He calls him later on, and this is in the dialogue as he addresses him. So it's kind of interesting how you can interact with somebody like this. He calls him to his face, you son of darkness and stench. Yet he also says that encased within the devil is the gold of the gods that must be beaten or forged out of him. Here also we may discern perhaps a foretaste of the black phase of alchemy, the dark massa confusa, out of which comes the alchemical gold. After having thus dealt with Satan, Jung encounters a strange group of beings. Now the Satan presumably goes back to warm himself along his own heating system in the nether regions. And now he encounters a strange group of beings, which he calls the Kabiri, C-A-B-I-R-I in the plural. This is it's a category of sort of spirits that was known in the ancient world, sometimes by other names also. He addresses them thus, what do you want? Speak. The Kabiri introduce themselves, and Jung describes them as elemental spirits. Those are the words that he uses. Dressed in wrinkled garb, with delightful misshapen forms, young and yet old. Those are Jung's words. The Kabiri eventually reveal themselves as potential or would-be helpers. They tell him that they forged his flashing sword and that they presented him with the knot that he needs to cut through in order to be free. And more about that knot in a few minutes. This, of course, is reminiscent of the famous legend concerning Alexander the Great, who, when he came to a particular town called Gordium, there was presented with a huge knot, which the residents there always brought to various important guests, asking them if they knew how to untangle that knot. And none of them had the dexterity to do so. Alexander, being a man of few words, just pulled out his sword and he cut through the knot. He said, here it is. So this is a little bit of a situation reminiscent of the Gordian knot. So he looks at the knot and he says to the Kabiri, the Kabiri speak to him first, we come to greet you as the master of the lower nature. I'm sure he didn't like that very much. And Jung says, are you speaking to me? Am I your master? The Kabiri says, you were not, but you are now. And then Jung says to them, so you declare, and so be it. Yet what should I do with your following? And now the Kabiri are here, and say to him, we also place before you the devilish skillfully twined knot that locks and seals you. Strike, only sharpness will cut through it. So they advise him to do something rather of the nature that Alexander did. And he is puzzled by this, and he says, let me see the great knot all wound round. Truly a masterpiece of inscrutable nature, a wily natural tangle of roots grown through one another. Only Mother Nature, the blind weaver, could work such a tangle. A great snarled ball and a thousand small knots, all artfully tied, intertwined truly. And then he says, as if, you know, the recognition comes to him, a human brain. Am I seeing straight? What did you do? You set my brain before me. That's a pretty scary thing. You set my brain before me. Did you give me a sword so that its flashing sharpness slices through my brain? What were you thinking of? The Kabiri. The womb of nature wove the brain. The womb of the earth gave the iron. So the mother gave you both, entanglement and severing. It's interesting to know that we have within ourselves the power to tie ourselves up in knots, but we also have within ourselves the power to free ourselves. So Jung says, mysterious. Do you really want to make me the executioner of my own brain? The Kabiri. It befits you as the master of the lower nature. Man is entangled in his brain, and the sword is also given to him to cut through the entanglement. Jung says, what is the entanglement you speak of? The Kabiri, the entanglement is your madness. The sword is the overcoming of madness. Jung says, you offerings of the devil, who told you that I am mad? You know, you little nasty things, you're here insulting me and calling me crazy. How can you do that to a psychiatrist like me, you know? You earth spirits, you roots of the day and excrement. No, that's a nice way to deal with them. Are you not yourself the root fibers of my brain? You polyp-snared rubbish. I will take note of these epithets. I think they might come in handy sometimes with arguing with some people. You polyp-snared rubbish, channel for juice knotted together, parasites upon parasites, all sucked up and deceived, secretly climbing up over one another by night. You deserve the flashing sharpness of my sword. You want to persuade me to cut through you? Are you contemplating self-destruction? How come nature gives birth to creatures that she herself wants to destroy? The Kabiri says, do not hesitate. We need destruction since we ourselves are the entanglement. He who wishes to conquer new land brings down the bridges behind him. Let us not exist anymore. We are the thousand canals in which everything also flows back again into its origin. Jung says, should I sever my own roots, kill my own people, whose king I am? Should I make my own tree wither? You really are the sons of the devil. The Kabiri, strike! We are servants who want to die for their master. He says, what will happen if I strike? The Kabiri say, then you will no longer be your brain, but will exist beyond your madness. Do you not see your madness is your brain, the terrible entanglement and intertwining in the connection of the roots, in the nets of canals, the confusion of fibers? Being engrossed in the brain makes you wild. Strike! He who finds the way rises up over his brain. You are a thumb in the brain, little bitty creature. Beyond the brain, you gain the form of a giant. We are surely sons of the devil, but did you not forge us out of the hot and dark? So we have something of its nature and of yours. The devil says that everything that exists is also worthy, since it perishes. As sons of the devil, we want destruction, but as your creatures, we want our own destruction. We want to rise up in you through death. We are roots that suck up from all sides. Now you have everything that you need, therefore chop us up, tear us out. What a curious bunch. Jung says, will I miss you as servants? As a master, I need slaves. The Kabiri, the master serves himself. Jung says, you ambiguous sons of the devil. These words are your undoing. May my words strike you. This blow shall be valid forever. The Kabiri, woe, woe. What we feared, what we desired has come to pass. So he kind of puts them out of business. So the keynote sounded by the Kabiri is that human consciousness is more than the brain. And you know what? I think that is a message that is greatly needed today. Half the time I turned on that miserable television said, there is some dingbat with an academic degree, brain. And, of course, the rationale behind all of this brainery that we are receiving now is what? That we are not but the body. And therefore, the important part, the creative part and so forth, is the brain. And it's really only the brain that is important. It's a sort of a typical metaphor of what Jung later on would call a one-sidedness of consciousness, an excessive valuing of the thinking function, among other things. So the Kabiri indicate to Jung here that human consciousness is more than the brain. They indicate that one must overcome the brain. These words are particularly meaningful these days, as I just mentioned. So according to the Red Book, the brain and its madness must be overcome. And the creators of this brain madness, the nature spirits or Kabiri, can be destroyed with these considerations. And of course we need to, by way of amplification, we need to keep in mind that when we depend on the brain for consciousness, we are entangled in the physical, in the material, and in the illusory. The Hindus would no doubt say that the brain is a creator of Maya, of illusion, and then we live in that illusion. There are other ways of interpreting it, of course, also. Namely, one being that the brain is a metaphor for material worldly thinking. But the literal meaning also has merit. It has been an axiom of the esoteric tradition all along that the brain is an instrument. The nervous system is an instrument of consciousness and not the creator of consciousness. And you got to remember now that the man who writes this is a medical doctor, Jung, you know, and a psychiatrist who has studied a great deal of neurology. So that this is, I think, of some interest. Jung then encounters a man who is in hell and who was once executed by hanging. And the reason for that was that this person poisoned his parents and his wife because, as he states to Jung, he wanted to transport them more quickly from a wretched life into eternal blessedness. The implication is that the method of killing people or even committing suicide in order to free oneself of earthly limitations is not a desirable way. But it's also probably significant that this image, this vision comes up immediately after the incident with the Kabiri. Because the Kabiri asked Jung to destroy them so that he can overcome their work. And this is, of course, let's say, a psycho-spiritual task. But if somebody interprets it too physically, then he may kill somebody or kill himself in order to overcome the material and the physical. So the way to overcome the brain is not to blow out your brains, if I may say so, but rather to rise to a kind of consciousness that is superior to the material and that uses the material as its instrument when desirable. Why do you suppose, by the way, I know this is a little bit off the subject, but not that much, why do you suppose that, say, in 19th century occultism, just theosophy, and so forth, there was so much emphasis on what was referred to as the astral body, the projection of the astral body, which really means the functioning of consciousness outside of the body? Well, there could be various reasons for it, but my feeling has been for a long time that the reason for that was because that is the grand metaphor that is to convince us that we are not the body, that we are not the brain, and that if we know how, we can function outside of the body. We can think outside of the brain. Nowadays, people say, think outside of the box. Well, maybe the brain is the box. you see, so I think it's an important issue because we so easily fall prey these days, and perhaps any day, to what a Tibetan teacher has called spiritual materialism. People say that they are concerned about consciousness. They are talking a lot, good line about consciousness, but all they are talking about is brain. All they are talking about is nervous system. All they are talking about are physical things, which are, of course, there and which allow us to function, but there is something else. And if we don't become aware of that something else, then we really don't know all that much. Now, in the ensuing conversation, the serpent, who brought the murderer up from hell, you know, the serpent becomes a real messenger. And Jung tells him, now go down again and bring up something else. So he brought up the Kabiri, he brought up this poor fellow who had committed that murder. And now the serpent assures Jung that one can never reconcile personal life with absolute life, because these two are not opposites, but simply differences. When I was reading this, the image came to me of, you know, one of the grand diagrams of everything, of a cross. And it seemed to me that the opposites which are to be reconciled could be placed on the horizontal bar of the cross, left, right, you know, yes and no, and dark and light and so forth. They're interacting with each other. But the vertical bar of the cross is something different. And that is, of course, what he is talking about here, that there the various elements are not opposites, but they are simply differences. So the overworld and the underworld are different from each other, but they are not really opposites. They are the emanations and the expressions of the same reality. Something like the central column of the Kabbalah. And so he talks here about personal life, absolute life. The absolute life, absolute reality, which is like the fullness of the Gnostic pleroma, is not the opposite of earthly conditioned life, but is simply different from it. Another dialogue ensues between Jung and the serpent. Jung is somewhat self-satisfied, as if he looked back upon some great accomplishment. But the serpent critically says, "Nah, don't be so smug," he says. "Nothing is accomplished yet." Jung tells the serpent that he is ready for more experience, and the serpent in turn tells him, "You are entitled to a reward for what has been accomplished so far." Also, the serpent tells him, "I give you payment in images." The images appear, and behold, they are our old friends whom he encountered quite a long time ago, Elijah and Salome, with whom he had such intense exchanges and experiences earlier. I don't want to recapitulate too much, but you may remember that as the result of his exchange with despair with Elijah and Salome, he underwent this major initiation, which was somewhat similar to a Mithraic initiation, where he was crucified, hanging on a cross, and Elijah and Salome were below, and he was able to remove the blindness of Salome, which we interpreted at that time as bringing the anima into consciousness. And so it was his great entry by way of a mystery rite into the deeper mysteries of the soul. Now these two are here again. So an interesting tableau of experiences unfolds. He speaks with Elijah and Salome and tells them that he doesn't really trust them a great deal and that maybe they ought to withdraw from his encounter. So he says, I am not sending you away. You must not be far from me, but give to me of your fullness. Give of fullness, not your longing. I cannot satisfy your poverty, just as you cannot still my longing. If your harvest is rich, send me some fruit from your garden. He's speaking now particularly to Salome, who wants to become his lover and go with him. If you suffer from abundance, I will drink from the brimming horn of your joy. I know that that will be a balm for me. I can satisfy myself only at the table of the satisfied, not at the empty bowls of those who yearn. I will not steal my payment. You possess nothing, so how can you give? Insofar as you give, you demand. Elijah, old man, listen, you have a strange gratitude. Do not give away your daughter, but set her on her own feet. She would like to dance, to sing or play the lute before people, and she would like their flashing coins thrown before her feet. This is, of course, imagery from the story of Salome, who dances before King Herod in order to get the head of John the Baptist. Salome, I thank you for your love. If you really love me, dance before the crowd. Please people so that they praise your beauty and your art. And if you have a rich harvest, throw me one of your roses through the window. And if the fount of your joy overflows, dance and sing to me once more. I long for the joy of men, for their fullness and freedom, and not their neediness. Because what has gone before, and which I did not read to you, is that Salome and Elijah both come, and Elijah says, well, here is my daughter, take her. And then Salome goes through all kinds of great declarations of love for Jung, that she would like to go with him, she would like to carry some of his burden, and so forth. But it's quite evident that both of them are acting out of a need to come to Jung and to, manifest through him. So what do we have here? This is not that easy to interpret. My interpretation, and I'm sure there are others, would be that these are, important great archetypes of his collective unconscious. The archetypes want to come forward. They want to achieve external expression by living themselves out through Jung. They have a need to enter him and to manifest through him. Now he sees that and he doesn't want that to happen, because he feels that if they come and, so to say, possess him and express themselves in that fashion, then that will not be really a desirable objective. That he wants to bring them to consciousness in another way, in a manner which does not satisfy their longing for taking him over. And this, of course, we could say a great deal about that, but this is definitely recognized in depth psychology as a considerable danger. We come in contact with some great archetypes, and mind you, these archetypes have been very, very important to him earlier, and through their presence he has entered an entirely different and much greater kind of consciousness, so he has a close connection with them. But still he does not want them to come and take hold of him and manifest through him, as it were. So the dialogue with Salome and with Elijah goes on. The essence seems to be that Salome wants to become his lover and close companion, and Jung is not prepared to accept this. He is not prepared to accept this. He does not wish to, as he says, I quote, become entangled with love. Somehow his relationship to both Salome and Elijah has changed. It is needful to recall also that at one time he experienced this major initiation through these figures, and it would seem that there is something other taking place. It's very difficult to discern exactly what it is. So I think the danger of a kind of archetypal possession is probably the clue to this situation. Then he discourses with Salome and with Elijah again. And Salome says to him, "What a hard and incomprehensible man you are." And Elijah says, "You have changed since I last saw you. You speak another language, one that sounds foreign to me." And Jung says to him, "My dear old man, I'd like to believe that you find me changed, but you too seem to have changed. Where is your serpent?" Because they had a serpent with them too. And Elijah says sadly, "She has gone astray. I believe she was stolen. Since then things have been somewhat gloomy with us. Therefore I would have been happy if you had at least accepted my daughter." Well, it's a kind of a strange logic, but if you lost the serpent, then you might as well get rid of your daughter also. I can see something in that, you know. Mm-hmm. So Jung says to him, "I know where your serpent is. I have her. We fetched her from the underworld. She gave me hardness, wisdom, and magical power. We need her in the upper world, since otherwise the underworld would have had the advantage to our detriment." This is rather transparent symbolism of bringing some power, some serpent power up from the underworld and have it available in consciousness, bringing the serpent as a particular power has been brought into consciousness by Jung and is no longer down in the underworld. Elijah doesn't like this, however. He says, "Away with you, accursed robber. May God punish you." And Jung says to him, "Your curse is powerless. Whoever possesses the serpent cannot be touched by curses. No, be sensible, old man. Whoever possesses wisdom is not greedy for power. Only the man who has power declines to use it. Do not cry, Salome. Fortune is only what you yourself create and not what comes to you. Be gone, my unhappy friends. The night grows late. Elijah, expunge the false gleam of power from your wisdom. And you, Salome, for the sake of our love, do not forget to dance." That's her job. Job is to dance. So the relationship to both has changed. Let's see. There is, I think, a little more dialogue going on with these folk. So the rejection of Salome and of her offered relationship is difficult to interpret. As we see it in context, the rejection does not appear to have been as final as it initially seemed, because Salome reappears again. as we see it in context, it doesn't seem to be quite as final. It seems that some further changes in Jung himself were required also before he could permit himself a closer relationship with Salome. One has to have a great deal of psychic strength when dealing with archetypes and when resisting, let's say, their tendency to obtain dominance over our consciousness. We need to interact with them. We need to get, you know, some of their wisdom, but we are not to be taken over by them. Now, Jung returns to the transformative mysteries which he experienced earlier in his process when he was crucified and returned the power of sight to Salome. He exclaims, "Mysteries, open your curtains again. I want to wage this battle to the end. Come here, serpent of the dark abyss." That's, of course, the serpent who is with him. The serpent appears again, and Jung complains to the serpent about the painful sacrifice he must undergo. He would like to get his mind off Salome, but the serpent reminds him that his sacrifice is necessary. Then he hears Salome crying, and he is greatly affected. He asks the serpent for advice, and they agree that such advice has to come from the beyond. So we have in this portion of the book the frequent reference to the beyond, and then the serpent becomes the messenger who goes to the beyond and brings back some directive, brings back some message. So the beyond is the deep unconscious to which in the ordinary course of affairs we have no access. So the serpent says, he asks the serpent for advice and they agree that has to come from the beyond. The serpent says that it is pulled upward. The serpent feels pulled upward, like he doesn't go down anymore as he did or she did before. She's always called she. And feels that she is pulled upward, and the serpent, behold, the serpent changes into a bird, which soars into the clouds and disappears. Jung then hears the voice of the bird, saying that it has found the crown in the heavens. The bird describes the crown as follows, a golden royal crown with lettering inscribed within, saying, "Love never ends." Replying to Jung's questioning, the bird says that even though it may prolong the suspense, it is as it must be. So Jung is eventually, we see him is actually once again suspended and crucified, and is undergoing another big sort of initiatory change. Now, a bit of tentative commentary of our own may be useful here. Once again, I would venture to suggest that Salome is Jung's anima. He has awakened her. He made her conscious at his initiations, that is, when she recovered her sight. Now the anima wants to be activated in various ways, either by taking him over or probably also by projection, where desire and love are mingled. And Jung rejects this at this point, but advised by the wise serpent, he realizes that the solution must come from a higher level. The serpent changing into a bird is the instrumentality of discovering this. The royal crown, declaring that love never ends, may help Jung to get off the cross upon which he is hanging, signifying indecision. In other words, he is in an undecided condition, and now help is coming him from a transcendental realm. The crown has the power to redeem Jung from his crucified state, but he does not understand this yet. Incidentally, the serpent that metamorphosed into the bird is Jung's soul in its dual earthly and heavenly aspect. As we will see later on when we come to the seven sermons to the dead, or if some of you who have read perhaps my translation and commentaries on the seven sermons to the dead in the Gnostic Jung, there a great role is played there by a serpent and a bird, the white bird. The white bird that comes from above and brings messages, and the serpent that goes on into the deep and brings wisdom from there. And so the implication here is that we, just like Jung, have, let's say, a duality of our soul, psyche. And these dual powers consist of one power that has the capacity to descend, let us say, into the realms that are deeply down below and that have to do with the earthly and the instinctual kind of wisdom of the cosmos. It may have occurred to many of you as to how much mention is made in various kind of New Age circles and so forth. You know, everything is cosmic, you know. I used to know a very dear old English lady who was, you know, she was sort of the hostess of the California occult in the 1950s and the 1960s, God rest her soul. And we always used to refer to her soirees as the cosmic tea parties, you know. I trust that she gives them now in an other, less material realm. In any event, you know, everything is cosmic, everything is cosmic. Well, this is, let's say, the realm of the serpent. We can derive wisdom from the deeper strata of the world. We can send the serpent into the dark caverns and passageways of the earth and have him bring back various items of wisdom from there. And they are useful to us. But we cannot succeed in the spiritual process purely by way of that. So eventually the serpent changes into the bird. Now the other aspect appears. And this is the one that goes to a supernal, to a transcendental realm. And in so doing brings us the kind of wisdom that the serpent cannot supply. I just allude in archetypally and artistically to the motif of the serpent and the bird. There is a lot of interesting material on that. Have you ever looked at the National Coat of Arms of Mexico? It's the eagle carrying the snake. And of course the legend behind it is that when the Aztecs came to what is now Mexico City, which was a kind of a swamp, some people feel that it's still much of a swamp with all the crime and so forth going on there. But in any event, the first thing that they saw was an eagle who was fighting with a rattlesnake and who grabbed the rattlesnake and flew off with it. So, you know, this is a kind of natural and martial symbolism of the two, the power of the netherworld, the snake, and the power of the overworld, the bird. Now, certainly the eagles always consider the very archetypal bird, the messenger of the gods of Jupiter particularly and so forth in the ancient world, that when the bird and the serpent appear together, then you have the energy from below and the energy from above that are conjoining. And only once in my life did I see it happen in this neck of the woods. We were driving out on the Malibu Canyon Road and looked up. There was a hawk carrying a snake. And the snake was still riding and moving. So this is the duality of the human psyche, the part of our psyche that is able to derive power and wisdom from the earth, and the power of the psyche that derives wisdom from the heavens. And these are the ones whom we, of course, we see here. So Salome is here now discoursing with Jung again. See, she hasn't really gone away. So Salome tells Jung that he is to be crowned. But what this means, she won't tell him. Her words are, hang until you understand, because he's there hanging on a tree again, he's hanging on a cross. So it's interesting to note that it is right at this point where Jung is brought the golden crown, and he is still hanging on the cross, that the calligraphic entry into the red book ceases. That is where he did not enter anymore into the calligraphy, although he wrote in the black books. It's anybody's guess why, but I'm sure Jung would be the first one to agree that such synchronicities are not without a meaning of their own. So that is where the rest of Book 2 and the entirety of the part called Scrutinies were found in the black books and in transcriptions which were intended to be entered into the red book. Now, Jung's suspension between heaven and earth, a veritable crucifixion agony, continues. Various spectral creatures appear to him as he is hanging there. One, a raven, who argues with him, telling him that the meaning of love never ends, which is inscribed on the crown, as the bird read the inscription on the crown and told him, that this is up to Jung's notion of love. The next creature to talk to him is another serpent. I tell you, snakes abound here in great profusion, who appears to be related to his own serpentine soul. This serpent is willing to help him, but confesses that this is a situation that is beyond its power. And the serpent tells him, you can use me in life, but not in hanging. The magic of the serpent does not suffice here. Soon, with a scornful laugh, our old friend Satan himself appears. He no doubt warmed himself in his underground warm place, and now he is here again. He calls to Jung, see what comes from the reconciliation of the opposites. Recant, and in a flash you will be down on the greening earth. He calls it here the greening earth. This, while we might call it stealing a little bit of a few words from Kazantzakis, the last temptation of Jung. This is rejected by Jung. No, I am not going to renounce my quest for the reconciliation of the opposites, no matter what you say, old hot, smelly one, you know. So he says, rejected by him, because he has no intention of recanting. Jung calls to his white bird, which has not shown itself yet. It went up, hasn't come back. So just maybe a minute of commentary here. Let's say the temptation is always before us in so many ways to renounce the difficult quest. Find some kind of a short but false way of dealing with the situation. Not to endure the tension of the opposites. And that is what he is doing here. He hangs on that cross because he is the instrument there of the interaction of the opposites, and he's trying to find a way within himself to reconcile them. But it's a terribly painful and arduous and lengthy process, and so the temptation is always there. Come on, you know, give up on this quest. Just take some kind of a false solution for it, and then everything will be all right. And that is, of course, what the devil tells him. And such false solutions, of course, are innumerable. I mean, we could be here all night and all week until the rains come back and go again to look at the kind of false solutions that the mind offers up, but they are always there, depending on the psychological type, depending on the situation of the individual. But there is an anecdote about Jung and a patient of his. And the patient brought a dream to him that she was sinking into a dark mire, like a swamp, you know, she was sinking down. And she obviously was quite unhappy about that, and she tried to get out, but she couldn't. And then she dreamt that Jung came sort of like a little winged creature came flying along and looked down at her from above as she was struggling there in the mess. And she, help me out, help me out. And he looked down at her and said, not out, but through. So this is the kind of thing when you endure the process, even though it's painful, you endure the tension of the opposites, then you come out with something better. But when you choose some kind of a seemingly easy, but yet not authentic way, then you are merely remaining in the condition in which you were, and no real, you know, no real transformation takes place. And so he is there hanging in, and he calls to the white bird. Salome appears, but she only says to Jung, ask yourself about the solution. You know? Then the bird arrives, and after a brief dialogue, he answers Jung's question, and Jung asks him, what should happen to Salome? But this is one of the great issues. He could not accept the anima the way the anima was coming forth. But something needs to be done. She is still there, and he doesn't quite know how to deal with her. And the bird answered, you see, Salome is what you are. Fly, and she will grow wings. So the indication being that the anima and you are really one, and as your consciousness takes wings, she also will, and she will fly along with you. Quite a verification of the idea that she is his anima. Then a frightful vision afflicts Jung. He sees a misshapen and seemingly inimical being arise, whom he identifies as his son of a magical kind. Jung identifies this creature with very derogatory terms. He calls him a destroyer. This is a good one, which I shall use on some people I know. A bug-eyed frog. A bug-eyed frog. Now, that's a nice thing to call somebody. A ridiculous and disgusting being. In his despairing wrath, Jung even blames Philemon for having magically afflicted him with this false son. Apparently his sense is that this was somehow the result of Philemon's magic. But it's a very ugly and very distasteful creature that appears before him here. Jung is extremely disturbed, and his serpent soul then comforts him with a long tale of a king who had no son and who went to a sorceress in order to magically create a child. The child is created and grows unnaturally fast, and having grown up strong and big, he roughly and impolitely and wildly demands that the royal father hand over the royal power to him. The king doesn't like that. He is taken aback and disappointed, and then he decides to have the son secretly killed, which comes to pass once again in a magical manner. But the king, this is the latter part of the story that the bird tells him. But the king was saddened, and when he could no longer master his melancholy, he returned yet again to the sorceress one night and asked for her advice. She spoke to him, dear king, you wanted a son, but the son wanted to be king himself, and also had the power and cleverness for it, and then you wanted your son no more. Because of this, you lost your son. Why are you complaining? You have everything, dear king, that you wanted, but the king said you are right. I wanted it so, but I did not want this melancholy. Do you have any remedies against remorse? The sorceress spoke, dear king, go to your son's grave, fill the pot again with otter's lard. Now that would be difficult to obtain. No doubt some old Swiss home remedy or something of that sort. Fill the pot with otter's lard, and after 9 months see what you find in the pot. The king did this and as he had been commanded, and henceforth he became happy and did not know why. When the 9 months had passed, he dug out the pot again. The body had disappeared, but in the pot there lay a sleeping infant, and he realized that the infant was his dead son. He took the infant to himself, and henceforth he grew as much in a week as other infants grow in a year. And when 20 weeks had passed, the son came before the father again and claimed his realm. But the father had learned from experience and already knew for a long time how everything would turn out. After the son had voiced his demand, the old king got up from his throne and embraced his son with tears of joy and crowned him king. And so the son who had thus become king was grateful to his father and held him in high esteem as long as his father was granted life. Now Jung then asks the storytelling serpent to give him an interpretation of this story. He says, all right, what does this mean? As might be expected, the serpent's interpretation is enigmatic. You know, it's a way they have, snakes. But the meaning that emerges is fairly plain. In our own words, even as indicated earlier in the book, in the story of Izdubar, that you may remember, so here also we are dealing with the bringing into manifestation of an other being who eventually reveals himself as the higher or divine self, known in the later formulation in Jungian psychology as the self with a capital S. The revelations given to Jung in the Red Book make it quite plain that recognizing this self and bringing it into conjunction with the human personality is really the great task of the human being. While the awakening of this self can be a glorious event, as described by the Red Book, as in the resurrection of Izdubar in the egg, that some of you may recall, here Jung reminds us that at times the personality may resent the coming of the self and resist with great force and anger. The metaphor of the birth of a child is a common one. People, both women and men, have dreams of giving birth to a child. The serpent tells Jung that he must become both father and mother to the new child. There is also a role reversal when the personal ego must acknowledge that it is the child of the self. The serpent says, for the sake of your son, you must be a child and leave your son the crown. That is what the story was all about, to convince him of that. Jung says, the thought that I must remain a child is humiliating and shattering. The serpent says, a salutary antidote against power. You know, you're still too concerned with your power. He says, you have to remember the sun stands higher. You are smaller and weaker than the sun. This is the bitter truth, but it can't be avoided. So subject yourself to the sun. Jung then very correctly recognizes that the subjection of the father, the personality, the Jung as he knows himself, to the son is a confrontation with a supernal being. And he says, where am I going to take hold of the immeasurable? My knowledge and ability are poor. My power is not enough. The serpent replies, do not ask after the morrow. Sufficient unto you is the day. You need not worry about the means. Let everything grow, let everything sprout. The son grows out of himself. So what we have here is a paradox, which you probably have confronted a number of times within yourselves. Namely, first of all, there are, and there are needed, and there come about magical, mystical processes and events, initiations and transformations. The guidance of Philemon bring Jung to this point. Yet, while he is in the midst of this confrontation with the self, he is told in effect that it is a natural process of growth. Just let it happen. Or as Jung has said, and as I love to quote him whenever possible, I don't make myself, I happen to myself. So what does this mean? It means we have to accept the stimuli that come to us in various ways on the way of transformation, on the way of the birth of the self. But once we are there, then let the self be self. Let the self come and take over. Just be relaxed. Let it happen. Don't try to make it happen. Don't try to dress it up. Don't try to glamorize it. Don't surround it with all kinds of things that you make up in order to make it look better to yourself. Let it happen. And when you let it happen, it happens. It's that accepting and really relaxed attitude that is extremely important. And then Jung says the myth commences, the one that need only be lived, not sung, the one that sings itself. That's a wonderful expression, the one that sings itself. I subject myself to the song, the one engendered by sorcery. Truly he is full of mysteries and superior in strength to all men. No man has produced him, and no woman has given birth to him. And so he is told that the serpent tells him, imagine that you are the old king and have a son. And then he says, who is the son? Well, I thought that you had just spoken of a son who doesn't make you very happy. In any event, he is convinced of the need to give way to this new being. So essentially, Jung relinquishes power to the greater self, who is called his son in this instance. He realizes that his life is enriched by this. It is implicitly recognized that all his resistance, his wrathful imprecations, some who were even directed against Philemon, were mistaken and misplaced. The Son has become a divine being to him, and he says, he speaks of the Son. He broke me into two. He cut me up, but he yokes the separated. Without him, I would fall apart, but my life goes on with him. My love remained with me. Jung describes a scene how he still nourishing some resentment at his spiritual son's newly won dominion, he repaired to his garden. Then from the water emerges his son, great and powerful, the crown in his hand. And these are the words that are in the book. With a swirling lion's mane, shimmering serpent skin covering his body. And this, of course, later on in the seven sermons, Jung calls a being like this Abraxas. And this was the figure, or is, I suppose it's still available, that Jung had carved into a stone and wore in his large ring that is usually called his Gnostic ring. It's a serpent with a lion's head and a lion's mane and a spiked halo surrounding his head. And that is the image that appears here as the image of his greater self, of this spiritual son. And this being now announces that he is about to depart. He says, I had become man and beast, and now ascend again to my country. When asked, where is your country? He answers, in the light, in the egg, in the sun, in what is innermost and compressed, in the eternal longing embers. So rises the sun in your heart and streams out into the cold world. And then the God is giving him a sort of a farewell speech. And here it is. He speaks to Jung. Jung says to him, you utter great riddles. And the God says to him, such is my language, and to you I leave the understanding. No one besides you has your own God. He is always with you, yet you see him in others, and thus he is never with you. You strive to draw to yourself those who seem to possess your God. You will come to see that they do not possess him, and that you alone have him. Thus you are alone among men, in the crowd, and yet alone. Solitude in multitude, ponder this. And he says, Jung says, I suppose I ought to remain silent after what you have said, but I cannot. My heart bleeds when I see you go from me. And he says, let me go. I shall return to you in renewed form. Do you see the sun, how it sinks red into the mountains? This day's work is accomplished, and now the sun returns. Why are you mourning the sun of today? And Jung says, must night fall? And he says, is it not mother of the day, the night as mother of the day? And Jung says, because of this night I want to despair. And he says, why lament? It is fate. Let me go. My wings grow and the longing toward eternal light swells up powerfully in me. This is again one of these beautiful poetic passages. You can no longer stop me. Stop your tears and let me ascend with cries of joy. You are a man of the fields. Think of your crops. I become light, like the bird that rises up into the skies of morning. Do not stop me, do not complain. Already I hover. The cry of life escapes from me. I can no longer hold back my supreme pleasure. I must go up. It has happened. The last cord tears away. My wings bear me up. I dive up into the sea of light. You who are down here, you distant twilight being, you fade from me. And he says, where have you gone? Something has happened. I am lamed. You know, has the God left him? And I believe and accept that the God is something different from me. He swung high and jubilant, with jubilant joy, I remain in the night of pain, no longer with the God, but alone with myself. So the important statement here is, I believe and accept that God is something different from me. So the self, the indwelling God, is in us, and yet it is different from us, in the sense that it is utterly different from the human ego or personality. It is the human soul as against the divine soul. The self manifests and then returns to its own place. This is the way it always happens. If anybody tells you that the self, the indwelling God, has come and is always there, unchanged or undiminished, they are making it up. That's not the way it works in a human being. Comes, and he goes back to his own place. But you know it's there, and you know it's going to come again. And as he says, he's going to come in a different form. Yet the God tells Jung, I shall return to you in renewed form. And he likens himself to the sun that sets in the evening and returns in the morning. Though such then is Jung's extremely dramatic confrontation with the inner God. At first he is horrified by its lowly form. Then, instructed by the serpent, he begins to see that he must relinquish his royal crown, which I would interpret as the power of his ego, to this being, who metaphorically appears as his son. Having done so, the God ascends to his own place, promising to return in renewed form. In the draft writing, not transcribed into the calligraphy, a curious paragraph appears, which is reproduced here, which possibly may point to future developments. That's at the very end of book two. It begins with the words, an opus is needed that one can squander decades on and do it out of necessity. He then indicates that he must, as he puts it, and these are his words again, catch up with a piece of the Middle Ages within himself. I would say that this is in all likelihood a prefiguration or an affirmation of Jung's channeling of the inspiration of the Red Book into alchemy, which occurred a good deal later. And underneath this paragraph, which is completely unrelated to the rest of the text, he wrote, finish. But of course it wasn't really finished, because the wealth of the material called scrutinies came thereafter, and it is to those that we will devote ourselves in the ensuing discussions. But I think we should leave with the very, very important and powerful thought and insight that the coming, the birth, the difficult and harrowing, initially resented birth of the greater self occurs within the individual. He recognizes him as such, and then the greater self goes back to its own place in order to come back to him again. And this, of course, is one of the two central points of the entire Red Book, that within us, potentially, there is a God. And this God must come forth. We must give birth to it, like a woman gives birth to a child. And when it has thus come forth, then he will be there and will be available and will continue to bless and guide us. And the indwelling power, of which we had just small intimations before, now will be there effectively, will irradiate, enlighten our lives, and lead us onward. And with that, the book 2 and the calligraph part actually has ended before, comes to an end, and that great explanatory and mysterious further revelation in scrutinies, as they are called, are to follow, to which we shall devote ourselves on the next number of evenings. So I hope that this has been of interest to you, and I thank you very much.
Copyright Union Office by Dimitri Recording. Catalog number 200508.
I might also append, not for the record, that this was, to me at least, one of the most difficult passages to work through and to try to interpret of everything that we have done so far. But I'm sure it's me. You see, I'm sure it's me. So, anyway, there we are.
For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, visit Gnosis.org. That's GNOSIS.org.